Chapter 27. Clayton, containing an English farthing. The receiver of it was a good deal moved. He called up Vienna and stood face to face with Mr. K and said, "I do not need to say anything. You can see it all in my face. My wife has the farthing. Do not be afraid, she will not throw it away." Apostrophe 3, correspondence of the London Times, Chicago, April 23, 1904. Now that the after developments of the Clayton case have run their course and reached a finish, I will sum them up. Clayton's romantic escape from a shameful death stepped all this region in an enchantment of wonder and joy during the proverbial 9 days. Then the sobering process followed, and men began to take thought and to say, "But a man was killed, and Clayton killed him." Others replied, "That is true. We have been overlooking that important detail. We have been led away by excitement." The telling soon became general that Clayton ought to be tried again. Measures were taken accordingly, and the proper representations conveyed to Washington. For in America, under the new paragraph added to the Constitution in 1889, second trials are not state affairs, but national, and must be tried by the most august body in the land, the Supreme Court of the United States. The justices were therefore summoned to sit in Chicago. The session was held day before yesterday, and was opened with the usual impressive formalities, the 9 judges appearing in their black robes, and the new Chief Justice, Lemaitre, presiding. In opening the case, the Chief Justice said, "It is my opinion that this matter is quite simple. The prisoner at the bar was charged with murdering the man Szczepanik. He was tried for murdering the man Szczepanik. He was fairly tried, and justly condemned and sentenced to death for murdering the man Szczepanik. It turns out that the man Szczepanik was not murdered at all. By the decision of the French courts in the Dreyfus matter, it is established beyond cavil or question that the decisions of courts are permanent and cannot be revised. We are obliged to respect and adopt this precedent. It is upon precedents that the enduring edifice of jurisprudence is reared. The prisoner at the bar has been fairly and righteously condemned to death for the murder of the man Szczepanik, and, in my opinion, there is but one course to pursue in the matter. He must be hanged." Mr. Justice Crawford said, "But, Your Excellency, he was pardoned on the scaffold for that." The pardon is not valid, and cannot stand, because he was pardoned for killing Szczepanik, a man whom he had not killed. A man cannot be pardoned for a crime which he has not committed. It would be an absurdity. But, Your Excellency, he did kill a man. That is an extraneous detail. We have nothing to do with it. The court cannot take up this crime until the prisoner has expiated the other one. Mr. Justice Halleck said, "If we order his execution, Your Excellency, we shall bring about a miscarriage of justice, for the governor will pardon him again. He will not have the power. He cannot pardon a man for a crime which he has not committed. As I observed before, it would be an absurdity." After a consultation, Mr. Justice Wadsworth said, "Several of us have arrived at the conclusion, Your Excellency, that it would be an error to hang the prisoner for killing Szczepanik instead of for killing the other man, since it is proven that he did not kill Szczepanik. On the contrary, it is proven that he did kill Szczepanik. By the French precedent, it is plain that we must abide by the finding of the court. But Szczepanik is still alive. So is Dreyfus. In the end, it was found impossible to ignore or get around the French precedent. There could be but one result. Clayton was delivered over for the execution. It made an immense excitement. The state rose as one man, and clamored for Clayton's pardon and retrial. The governor issued the pardon, but the Supreme Court was in duty bound to annul it, and did so, and poor Clayton was hanged yesterday. The city is draped in black, and, indeed, the like may be said of the state. All America is vocal with scorn of French justice, apostrophe and of the malignant little soldiers who invented it, and inflicted it upon the other Christian lands. 1. Pronounced approximately, Chopinic. About play acting, I have a project to suggest. But first I will write a chapter of introduction. I have just been witnessing a remarkable play, here at the Burg Theater in Vienna. I do not know of any play that much resembles it. In fact, it is such a departure from the common laws of the drama that the name play doesn't seem to fit it quite snugly. However, whatever else it may be, it is in any case a great and stately metaphysical poem, and deeply fascinating. Deeply fascinating is the right term. For the audience sat 4 hours and 5 minutes without thrice breaking into applause, except at the close of each act, sat rapt and silent, fascinated. This piece is the Master of Palmyra. Apostrophe, it is 20 years old, yet I doubt if you have ever heard of it. It is by Wilbrandt, and is his masterpiece and the work which is to make his name permanent in German literature. It has never been played anywhere except in Berlin, and in the great Burg Theater in Vienna. Yet whenever it is put on the stage it packs the house, and the free list is suspended. I know people who have seen it 10 times, they know the most of it by heart, they do not tire of it. And they say they shall still be quite willing to go and sit under its spell, whenever they get the opportunity. There is a dash of metempsychosis in it, and it is the strength of the piece. The play gave me the sense of the passage of a dimly connected procession of dream pictures. The scene of it is Palmyra in Roman times. It covers a wide stretch of time, I don't know how many years, and in the course of it the chief actress is reincarnated several times. 4 times she is a more or less young woman, and once she is a lad. In the first act she is Zoe, a Christian girl who has wandered across the desert from Damascus, to try to Christianize the Zeus-worshipping pagans of Palmyra. In this character she is wholly spiritual, a religious enthusiast, a devotee who covets martyrdom and gets it. After many years she appears in the second act as Phoebe, a graceful and beautiful young light-o-love from Rome, whose soul is all for the shows and luxuries and delights of this life, a dainty and capricious feather-head, a creature of shower and sunshine, a spoiled child, but a charming one. In the third act, after an interval of many years, she reappears as Persida, mother of a daughter who is in the fresh bloom of youth. She is now a sort of combination of her two earlier selves. In religious loyalty and subjection she is Zoe. In triviality of character and shallowness of judgment, together with a touch of vanity in dress, she is Phoebe. After a lapse of years she appears in the fourth act as Nymphas, a beautiful boy, in whose character the previous incarnations are engagingly mixed. And after another stretch of years all these heredities are joined in the Zenobia of the fifth act, a person of gravity, dignity, sweetness, with a heart filled with compassion for all who suffer, and a hand prompt to put into practical form the heart's benignant impulses. There are a number of curious and interesting features in this piece. For instance, its hero, Apelles, young, handsome, vigorous, in the first act, remained so all through the long flight of years covered by the 5 acts. Other men, young in the first act, are touched with gray in the second, are old and racked with infirmities in the third. In the fourth, all but one are gone to their long home, and this one is a blind and helpless hulk of 90 or 100 years. It indicates that the stretch of time covered by the piece is 70 years or more. The scenery undergoes decay, to the decay of age assisted and perfected by a conflagration. The fine new temples and palaces of the second act are by and by a wreck of crumbled walls and prostrate columns, moldy, grass-grown, and desolate, but their former selves are still recognizable in their ruins. The aging men and the aging scenery together convey a profound illusion of that long lapse of time. They make you live it yourself. You leave the theater with the weight of a century upon you. Another strong effect. Death, in person, walks about the stage in every act. So far as I could make out, he was supposedly not visible to any excepting two persons, the one he came for and Appel's. He used various costumes. But there was always more black about them than any other tint, and so they were always somber. Also they were always deeply impressive, and, indeed, awe-inspiring. The face was not subjected to changes, but remained the same first and last, a ghastly white. To me he was always welcome, he seemed so real, the actual death, not a play-acting artificiality. He was of a solemn and stately carriage, and he had a deep voice, and used it with a noble dignity. Wherever there was a turmoil of merry-making or fighting or feasting or chaffing or quarreling, or a gilded pageant, or other manifestation of our trivial and fleeting life, into it drifted that black figure with the corpse-dash face, and looked its fateful look and passed on, leaving its victim shuddering and smitten. And always its coming made the fussy human pack seem infinitely pitiful and shabby, and hardly worth the attention of either saving or damning. In the beginning of the first act, the young girl Zoe appears by some great rocks in the desert, and sits down exhausted, to rest. Presently arrive a pauper couple stricken with age and infirmities, and they begin to mumble and pray to the spirit of life, who is said to inhabit that spot. The spirit of life appears, also death uninvited. They are supposedly invisible. Death, tall, black-robed, corpse-faced, stands motionless and waits. The aged couple pray to the spirit of life for a means to prop up their existence and continue it. Their prayer fails. The spirit of life prophesies Zoe's martyrdom. It will take place before night. Soon Appel's arrives, young and vigorous and full of enthusiasm. He has led a host against the Persians, and won the battle. He is the pet of fortune, rich, honored, believed, master of Palmyra. He has heard that whoever stretches himself out on one of those rocks there, and asks for a deathless life can have his wish. He laughs at the tradition, but wants to make the trial anyway. The invisible spirit of life warns him. Life without end, can be regret without end. ... But he persists. Let him keep his youth, his strength, and his mental faculties unimpaired, and he will take all the risks. He has his desire. From this time forth, act after act, the troubles and sorrows and misfortunes and humiliations of life beat upon him without pity or respite, but he will not give up, he will not confess his mistake. Whenever he meets death, he still furiously defies him, but death patiently waits. He, the healer of sorrows, is man's best friend. The recognition of this will come. As the years drag on, and on, the friends of the master's youth grow old, and one by one they totter to the grave. He goes on with his proud fight, and will not yield. At length he is wholly alone in the world, all his friends are dead. Last of all, his darling of darlings, his son, the lad Nymphas, who dies in his arms. His pride is broken now, and he would welcome death, if death would come, if death would hear his prayers, and give him peace. The closing act is fine and pathetic. Appel's meets Zenobia, the helper of all who suffer, and tells her his story, which moves her pity. By common report she is endowed with more than earthly powers, and since he cannot have the boon of death, he appeals to her to drown his memory in forgetfulness of his griefs, forgetfulness which is death's equivalent. She says, roughly translated, in an exaltation of compassion, "Come to me. Kneel, and may the power be granted me to cool the fires of this poor tortured brain, and bring it peace and healing." He kneels. From her hand, which she lays upon his head, a mysterious influence steals through him, and he sinks into a dreamy tranquility. Oh, if I could but so drift through this soft twilight into the night of peace, never to wake again. raising his hand, as if in benediction. O Mother Earth, farewell. Gracious thou were to me. Farewell. Appels goes to rest. Apostrophe apostrophe, death appears behind him, and encloses the uplifted hand in his. Appels shudders, wearily and slowly turns, and recognizes his lifelong adversary. He smiles and puts all his gratitude into one simple and touching sentence, Ich danke dir, apostrophe and dies. Nothing, I think, could be more moving, more beautiful, than this close. This piece is just one long, soulful, sardonic laugh at human life. Its title might properly be, Is Life a Failure? Apostrophe apostrophe and leave the five acts, to play with the answer. I am not at all sure, that the author meant to laugh at life. I only notice, that he has done it. Without putting into words any ungracious or discourteous things about life, the episodes in the piece seem to be saying all the time, inarticulately. Note what a silly poor thing human life is, how childish its ambitions, how ridiculous its pomps, how trivial its dignities, how cheap its heroisms, how capricious its course, how brief its flight, how stingy in happinesses, how opulent in miseries, how few its prides, how multitudinous its humiliations, how comic its tragedies, how tragic its comedies, how wearisome and monotonous its repetition of its stupid history through the ages, with never the introduction of a new detail, how hard it has tried, from the creation down, to play itself upon its possessor as a boon, and has never proved its case in a single instance. Apostrophe apostrophe, take note of some of the details of the piece. Each of the five acts contains an independent tragedy of its own. In each act someone's edifice of hope, or of ambition, or of happiness, goes down in ruins. Even Appel's perennial youth is only a long tragedy, and his life a failure. There are two martyrdoms in the piece, and they are curiously and sarcastically contrasted. In the first act the pagans persecute Zoe, the Christian girl, and a pagan mob slaughters her. In the fourth act those same pagans, now very old and zealous, are become Christians, and they persecute the pagans. A mob of them slaughters the pagan youth, Nymphas, who is standing up for the old gods of his fathers. No remark is made about this picturesque failure of civilization. But there it stands, as an unworded suggestion that civilization, even when Christianized, was not able wholly to subdue the natural man in that old day, just as in our day the spectacle of a shipwrecked French crew clubbing women and children who tried to climb into the lifeboats suggests that civilization has not succeeded in entirely obliterating the natural man even yet. Common sailors a year ago, in Paris, at a fire, the aristocracy of the same nation clubbed girls and women out of the way to save themselves. Civilization tested at top and bottom both, you see. And in still another panic of fright we have this same tough civilization saving its honor, by condemning an innocent man to multiform death, and hugging and whitewashing the guilty one. In the second act a grand Roman official is not above trying, to blast Appel's reputation by falsely charging him with misappropriating public monies. Appel's, who is too proud to endure even the suspicion of irregularity, strips himself to naked poverty, to square the unfair account, and his troubles begin. The blight which is to continue, and spread strikes his life. For the frivolous, pretty creature whom he brought from Rome has no taste for poverty, and agrees to elope with a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.